shrugged off all of my agenda anxieties. A couple of days ago, I was walking up the trail with Carol Hinderly, and I'm getting to know him as the week goes on, and he said, you know, we were a little nervous about bringing you up here. And I don't know why. I'd be nervous about Will or Rosemary or so, but I'm kind of meek and mild type. What could I possibly have made you nervous about? Well, you have the reputation of being our most structured and organized theologian, and we're so unstructured and disorganized up here, we thought we'd throw you off. Well, I don't know. I'm cultivating a little Dionysianism here. I'm learning psychedelic print and doing my best to hang loose and having a grand time. This is our third and last of the general rounds. Tonight, I am due for a forum, and I'm wondering, since we don't get a lot of discussing in the morning, whether you can, by the end of this morning, give me a couple clues of what we ought to be talking about tonight. I can think about it a little bit during the day and maybe lead off with it, and we may do better than if I just have to respond wholly at random. I told the group on the lawn yesterday at 4 o'clock that Elmer Witt, my look-alike, I get kissed all over around here. Total strangers come up. They all think I'm Elmer. Elmer told me that he was on to me because he became on to himself. He said, whenever a speaker gets up, as I did Monday and Wednesday, and say, I'm not going to say much today because I really want to discuss with you and I want to hear what you have to say, that's usually a guy who knows himself well enough. He's a filibuster and a blabbermouth and so on, and his hour will be gone suddenly and you won't have discussed. It happened both times, and the odds are strong today. But tonight we do have forum, and that'll be my last chance with you, so at the end of this period, I'll at least ask some of the kinds of things you think we ought to talk about tonight. Well, that's my morning set of irrelevancies, and now I'll suddenly get relevant and much less pleasant. I thought I'd begin today as we move from world through church to person. Today we have to talk about the human capacity, as Hannah Arendt says on the quotation, for building, preserving, and caring for a world. And we have a terrific problem today that an awful lot of people, including the people with the highest potentials, the most gifted people in our culture, are not so sure that we have a world which is capable of providing room for building, preserving, and caring. That there is no future, that it is only futile, or that the way the system is put together allows for no possibility of a human making a difference. I don't have any easy answers on that front. I think anyone who pretends to nowadays is just chattering. But that doesn't mean we can't address ourselves to a situation in which we don't have answers. We may have some clues, and we want to piece together a little of that today. And the best way to start, I think, is to look at some of the people and some of the reasons. Some of the people who see problems with what we've had, and some of the reasons that they see the problem. And then look at those who either want to blow the whole thing apart, or who have some hope in what I'm talking about this week, as a developing worldview. So, a couple of illustrations. As I sat here last night during our dialogue, I kept thinking of a line from James Baldwin. When I always think of this, first of all, Will is all alone there, and there are 80 of us, and he and the Holy Spirit vastly outnumbered. And then I look back, and he keeps reminding us, are you spending any time exploring your own society? Now, if I were the one in his 80, I would probably do the same thing. Are you guys so sure this is right and that's right? But that's not the issue for us, this majority. Are we so sure that what we have is the kingdom of God? Are we so sure that what we have is a society that has removed people from what Hannah Arendt calls their futility, their instability? And the line that came to me was James Baldwin's in The Fire Next Time. It was the first book that signaled the change in the racial movement in America, must be 6-7 years old by now already, or more. He said, you guys are always worried about whether your daughter should marry me or whether I should marry your daughter. Are you so sure I want to be integrated into a burning house? And it seems to me that this is what we ought to be on now more, our burning house. Robert McAfee Brown says, people who've been dealt four aces don't ask for a new deal. And we're the four ace people. You can't be white middle class American without being to the rest of the whole world the four ace people. And this means for them, they either are going to have to offer us something so much more attractive that we'll ask for a new deal, or they'll have to heat up the house or burn it down so that we may move out, so that there may be some chance of some sort of a reshuffling. So that's the first thing that came to my mind. Second was a view of our culture that it gives without knowing that it gives it. Came home very strong to Elsa and me a couple of weeks ago in our own home. When you hear people in the black movement or young people speak about the violence of our culture, again, this is something that we think is always at a distant remove from us. We don't think of how visible it is. Is what we have all that good? We're back to this question. Are there good reasons for the gifted and the restless and the young and others to look for a better culture and a better worldview and a better way of putting life together? The father of our African boys was over recently to visit them, Mr. Semakadi, whose firm in Kampala, Uganda, flew him to Malta, and he said, and since I was halfway here, they helped pay my way to come and see my boys. He lived with a single swinging bachelor lawyer who brought his boys over to the States in the first place. This lawyer lives on the lake shore of Chicago, blocked from the lake. If you know Chicago at all, it's 2000 North Clark. If you've heard of the Fleam East Restaurant, it's our poshest place, and that's in that building that he lives. It's a very plush apartment, and our boy's father stayed there for about 10 days and was often out at our place to spend the days with the boys. And the last evening, we had him to dinner, and I said, now, what impressions are you going to take back to Africa? This man, by the way, was a good friend of Tom Mboya, who was assassinated during this time, and we talked a great deal about tribal warfare and intrigues of Africa, and I had my impressions of Africa. Now, Mr. Semakadi, who has a kind of an Oxford accent, a very cultured man, what impressions you get of America? What was the best thing you did in Chicago? He said, well, I would always get 15 cents, and I would go into little places, and I would have coffee, and then I would always find a table where there was a little room, and I'd sit down with other people, and I'd get into conversation. That was the most interesting thing, because they always thought he was an American black. And then as he began visiting, he began to be accepted because he was from 10,000 miles away. And then he had a very interesting angle on our culture. I said, well, now what's the total impression you take back? When you go back to people, he'd seen the skyscrapers, he'd seen the beauties. We took him on the facade tour of Chicago. What are you going to tell him? How violent you are. And I said, well, now don't just believe television and the movies and what we say about ourselves. Don't just read the front page of the newspapers. And then the lawyer said, he was there at the dinner too, he said, I think Mr. Semakadi came by that impression quite naturally. You see, he's been living in our city. He said, now here's what happens. Sorry, gas. Here is the downtown of Chicago. This is the action. This is what Mr. Semakadi wants to know about. Here we live, 2000 North Clark. Park Street, Lake, rich area, Old Town, which is our Greenwich Village or Bourbon Street or whatever. Not as good as them, but it's there. Cabrini, public housing projects, etc. He said, two nights ago, Mr. Semakadi was in Old Town, and as you well read in the morning paper, a guy parked his car half a block west of Wells Street. If you're in Chicago, you'll all go to Wells Street. He parked a half a block west. And he and his fiance were walking to the car, and some kids, probably narcotics, the heavy narcotics area, killed him. Well, Mr. Semakadi's half a block away, and you read it in the paper, there he was. Then you saw the picture of the Morning Tribune of a guy at 2100 North Clark who was being burglarized didn't know what to do, ran for his camera. The burglar goes halfway down the steps. The guy took his picture. There it was on the cover. Handed over to the cops. They got that one. Well, that kind of, that does make an impression that we're so technological we take photos of the people out together. There were two other murders within two blocks during those 10 days, and then he said each day as he would head out to go to some little place to have his 15 cents worth of coffee, I would say, now whatever you do, stay on Clark Street. If you go a block west, blacks will kill you. If you go a block east, whites will kill you. You better stay right on here. Now, I thought, I live in Chicago. I don't think of that all there. Yes, I do think of that all there. I wouldn't for $5 million park a half a block west of Wells Street. And if I were a black, I wouldn't for $10 million get myself involved a block east of Wells Street. We just know it and we live with it. You all have a mental map of any metropolis you're near and you know exactly how it is. Guy from Memphis who was black was in Chicago and got a flat tire and went to fix it. Two friends, and happened to be in a white neighborhood, and he was dead in a few minutes. All right, this is all happening while our friend is here. We don't see it because we do find ways of living on our little Clark streets. We've got our churches properly located or whatever. By the way, for most of you, if you live in Bismarck or Caldwell, Idaho, or somewhere like that, Clark Street also is not... quiet little street itself, and most of you probably wouldn't walk there either at night. So, are you sure we want to be integrated into a burning house? Secondly, you are the most violent nation, Tom Oboya's friend tells me. And then, my third little picture, how the young come to their frustration. And in every case, I hope I've tried to show all week long, I'm not uncritical of any of the groups through whose eyes I'm trying to see America. And I'm not uncritical of the young either, but let's see again now how they come to their frustration. My friend Peter Berger, a Lutheran lay sociologist, part-time theologian, and one of the best in the business, tells me that he's giving a lot of thought to the student revolution and why it's happening now. Funny thing, it almost crowded the other revolutions off the map this year. This is the incomprehensible one to us. Black, we can understand a little bit. All the others, we can understand a little bit. But why are our kids, our nice kids, so discontented with what's around? Well, he said, let's see this at least psychologically. He'd read Philip Ariès' book, Centuries of Childhood. Very interesting book, because it points out that childhood as we know it is a modern concept. Look at paintings of 3 centuries ago, and you'll see the children are miniature adults. Look at a Goya painting. Children are dressed... you're an infant, often not weaned until 3-4 years, and then you are suddenly a miniature adult. And childhood, the 4 to 14 years, is a modern concept, and it's only in our very recent era, don't blame Spock for it, that we've enlarged this concept and given it place. Now, what happens in childhood? He said, while he was reading Ariès' book, he also was reading the life of the Gautama Buddha, who was the son of an Indian prince. And the prince's father, I mean the prince himself, Gautama Buddha's father, wanted to bring up his son the way a prince should be brought up. He should grow to maturity, never seeing misery, disease, poverty, death. And he pretty well pulled it off because he had the wealth and the luxury to just segregate this child from the human condition. And Berger said, and it occurred to me, that's the standard experience of an American suburban kid, 4 to 14. 10 minutes after an auto accident which 4 people can be killed, you can't see there was an auto accident. The glass is swept away, the steel is gone, the cars are towed away, no bodies around. The average American child never sees a death. Grandma and grandpa used to live up in the attic and spend their last years declining there and dying. Grandma and grandpa are carted away to a safe distance, and as soon as they stop being healthy, the children stop getting to see them. It might shake them up too much if grandpa has cancer and they have to see that he isn't as pretty as he was. The mentally ill don't line our streets. We put them away in institutions where we never have to confront them. Now, they get a little filtering of our Mr. Santicotti's view of our violence or James Baldwin's view of our burning house, or Robert Maxley's Brown view of the four ace people who are oblivious to the world around them. They get it filtered to them through perhaps the instrument that's done more than anything else to create the need for a new consciousness, namely television, which is constant violence. If any of you ever bother to look at Saturday morning cartoons or anything else, turn on television, and whether news time or anything else, the odds are about 10 to 1 that you'll see somebody get killed in a couple of minutes. But that's a funny way of seeing it, because right after it they have ultra-bright sex appeal and all the rest, so it's a very domesticated, safe version of it. And then suddenly you begin to come into contact with the world, and, says Berger, all these years you'd been given the impression that the world could be a happy place, and now you find it can't. This is the frustration. So in a sense, most of the young people I know are in a way frustrated utopians. They have been given the impression that the world could be a happy place, and they run head-on into a world that is not capable of presenting this happiness, and so they are hungry for something different. I'm not a utopian, but I'm interested in the utopian vision, and I'm interested in what latent power is in it. So I meet the products of that in my classes. I have an interesting situation in Chicago because I teach in three faculties, divinity, history, and history of culture. And I never have a class of only divines, who are they're the most secular people in the university, I think, or only historians, who are very religious these days. But they're all mixed up, they're all jumbled together, and I get a kind of a cross-section. Now, it's true, they're not a perfect cross-section because they're graduate students. And graduate students are much less interesting than undergraduate students. By the time you're in grad school, you already know what you have to do, and you don't dare learn anything that doesn't relate to your topic because that would confuse you. So they're not quite as good, but they're not far enough from their BA to be wholly corrupted yet, and I get a little vision of it. Last year I was in one of these interdisciplinary courses talking about the American experience. I had my little chart brought right over Clark Street that we used the other day, religious institution, sacred cosmos, and worldview. And I was developing the thesis one day that when there's shaking up in religious institutions, it doesn't hurt anybody, and when there's a creative change in them, it doesn't seem to help anybody. If there's conflict between the Methodists and the Baptists, nobody's going to get killed, right? I have a thesis that the denomination is a wonderful American invention to keep anybody from getting hurt. If we had had religious wars on the European style, we got 250 denominations. There wouldn't be anybody left. But we invent the denomination which allows all of us to say what we believe in is very important, but we're all very nice to everybody else. So consensus based on denomination isn't a very deep consensus, and conflict between denominations isn't very deep. Have you ever noticed when someone sidles up to you and tells you the latest joke about the rabbi, the priest, and the minister? He thinks he's doing something very dangerous, and he's doing something very safe, right? He thinks it's near blasphemy, and it's just about going to blow the culture apart, and after I'm finished yawning, because I have to have heard them all I can think is this is a wonderful little mechanism our society developed. If we can laugh about these ultimate commitments a little bit, or the funny people who have to bear them, then society will hold together. In the history of America, I can't count more than a half a dozen dead bodies as a result of religious warfare. The Presbyterians killed a Mason up in New York in the 1830s. Or at least we think they did. They can't find him. They haven't found him yet. And the Mormons lost a martyr or two, and were involved in a little shooting war in Utah one time. And a few Catholics were killed in a riot in Philadelphia in the 1840s. But for the most part, we're pretty safe there. But I said, now let's get into these two realms. The sacred cosmos, remember the other day, our civil religion, our societal religion. Have you ever noticed you need religious symbols whenever you really want to change society, I told them. I said, thus, we never were able to remove the Indian without religious symbols. Now, the churches didn't tell people this all the time. The whole society knew it. You ought to read. I've just written a new history, Bicentennial History of American Protestantism. Comes out next year, and you won't be able to miss it. 100,000 copies in the first printing. And I start my chapter on the removal of the Native American. And I just looked up all the texts. How did we justify the fact that we always kept killing Indians and moving them on and killing them and moving them on and so on? We always had a Bible passage for it. We were the chosen people coming to the promised land. What did God let his people do then? Kill off the Canaanites? Well, we had somebody too. Okay, so there are a lot of dead bodies as a result of religion in this sphere. It's a little more tricky. or black-white relations. The whole story of Ham, whoever cooked that one up, we sure needed a story. There isn't a clue in the Bible that Ham had anything to do with the black races, but I bet you there are people in this room who still got it in childhood Sunday school. We needed the story to come out that way. North and South, both sides knew that God was on their side. The South knew that the Bible said you better have slaves. The North knew that the Bible said you better have not have slaves. So in this realm, people do get killed because of our religion. But I said, if you really want to shake up society, let it go through a change in its worldview itself. I'm not sure people get killed because of that, but they get a lot of psychic disturbance. And I use two illustrations, the Enlightenment in America. America was born in the time of the Enlightenment. And Christianity had to go through a tremendous adjustment to relate to the world of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and Benjamin Franklin, who were their own kind of pagans. They talked about God in very abstract terms. They did everything they could not to be caught being quite Christian. And we learned some things about natural reason and natural law from them. And this is bonded into our way of looking at life. And then I said, and then a century later, we had a big shift in this, what I talked about the other day, the Darwinian worldview. Then I would always come finally to the point of having to say, and I think we're going through something like that now again. And it was interesting to me, that's when the class would perk up. And what do they want? They want a class this next year on, now tell us what's going on now. Well, I was telling them, I'm a historian, you have to wait till it's over with before I have anything to say. But I can talk about yesterday or 2 minutes ago, because that belongs to my realm. So this year we're going to try to have a seminar and spell out, is something going on as deep as the Enlightenment? A whole new theology came into our lives with it. You don't even know how much you got in your bones. We'll talk about it tonight if you want. Or Darwinian, a whole new theology became part of the working way of looking at life for all of us. And there's no president and no congressman and no senator who can expect to get anywhere without coping with both of them. Now we're in the middle of another. Now, then the students come alive. Why? Well, for one thing, I think they come alive because to be young, especially to be young in a time of modern media, puts you in instant communication with what other young are doing. And as a general mood, there's a strong sense of burning house, violent nation, unhappy world, and a repudiative and a rejective sense. I think it's the most wonderful time to teach history, because the people coming on the scene instinctively think there's nothing in it. Worst time to teach history is when people think the past will automatically teach its lessons. Many of you had history as your least favorite subject because you had somebody standing in front of you who assumed you were interested in it. Notice how Roland Bainton always does as a historian. He first lets us know that Erasmus and Luther were in a revolution like the Enlightenment and Darwin and today. Even this such a safe little topic as the women of the Reformation, he lets us know, is a bit interesting because male-female relations are undergoing a dramatic change today, and let's look at a few of these models from the past. He doesn't assume that you're going to be interested. Now, he happens to be such an interesting lecturer, he could discuss, pick your topic, flaws in Arabian rugs. No, I'd be there. Our friend over here says, every time I see him, I just have an irresistible urge to sit on his lap. being a boy, I can't do that, but I can drag my couch around. And so he happens to be that kind of lecturer. But even people that aren't that good are interesting if they know that the past isn't speaking automatically to young people today. Pow, first you got to get their attention. And their attention is directed to, first, this sense of rejection of the past. Now, with this goes a little bit of what theologians call hubris, or pride. Jakob Burckhardt, my favorite historian of the 19th century, says, every generation likes to think that all ages are being fulfilled in its own, as if the whole past existed just for us. There's some of that. Okay. Judge not, and you shall not be judged. Secondly, though, not only repudiating the past, there's a little vestigial sense, at least, that it'd be nice if my life counted. We make so much in America of pioneers and frontiersmen and so on. And they think it'd be kind of nice if their life counted somewhere. Here's where they find so many doors closed. We say America's a land of opportunity. We look at the lists of vocations open to them, and we wonder why they can't find how to make a life count. Why do they go to all the films that show the futility of people who are trying to make their lives count? That's a standard plot in today's film. Somebody who was so silly that he really thought it would matter, and then he gets clobbered from all sides. But there's a vestigial sense. It would be nice if, given these few years, some little thing had happened. And for a few years, there were some going into Peace Corps and VISTA and Job Corps that way. Some still do. But they're looking for a new opening. And I think with this, I'd have to say they want a new consciousness. The question that they keep coming back to me with is, what is so good about what we now have? And I write books about using the kingdom of God as a symbol that comes to us from the future. To me, the fundamental thing about Christianity, insofar as it relates to the world, is that it never lets it alone. Every time somebody came on the scene and told any prophet that what we had was pretty good, law and order, support things as they are, boy, you find one line in the prophets in support of law and order. Let's make that a challenge. Find me one line of a guy who sat back and said, what we've got is good, let's enforce it. Every prophetic line in the scripture, Jesus, John, Malachi, Obadiah, Hosea, Joel, Amos, and, oh, I'm going backward now. Find a line. To be involved with biblical faith means to have a vision of a future that somehow is in tension with everything we've now got. I like, since I'm using Hannah Arendt this week, I like one of the quotations she found in Luther. This always is a good way to build rapport with an audience of this kind. Probably three-fourths of you respond positively when you hear Luther. It sounds so safe. The Word of God has come into the world so that for its sake the world will be thrown into uproar, tumultuator. Princes will tremble. Its purpose is to revive and change the whole world to the extent that it reaches it. Okay, here are people coming on the scene who ask me constantly, all right, what values, not in general, but precisely what values do you believe are worth imparting elsewhere? There are some. Don't ask me right now, but we'll talk about it tonight. There's some hopes, there's some dreams, there's some things like this. But the way we put life together, what is so good about imparting? So there's a strong hunger for change. 10 years ago, my favorite British philosopher, Ernest Gellner, wrote a book called Thought and Change. I underlined some lines in it because I agreed with him so much 10 years ago. And now I wonder how he could have written it and I could have thought it. I like Gellner because he's not a cold fish philosopher. He's a man who says philosophy is about change. And modern philosophy is about the change brought about by industrialization and political change and so on. There's a passage in there which he says, it's hard for me to picture any kind of revolution in industrialized and affluent societies. I underlined it. Why? Because such societies have come to an approved social contract. And you can revise it, you can do a footnote to it, but you aren't going to fundamentally change it. Why? Because, he said, the non-industrialized, non-affluent societies are looking for just that. Their revolution is for what we've got. And he puts it up the way I would too, and I have to agree here. He says, given the choice between having short life, hard work, meaningless, non-productive labor, disease, discomfort, insecurity, bad food, on the one hand, and given, on the other, the potential of a longer life, some leisure, some physical comfort, some opportunity, and so on, which would people take? Over the long pull, I assume they'd take the second of these. If they want the second of these, they're going to have the mixed benefits of what we call technology. In our little session yesterday, I used medical technology as one example. If you really want to be totally anti-technology, are you ready to throw out cancer research? Are you ready to throw out all of that? We're going to have the mixed blessings of a technological society. And I agree with him, and I suppose he still agrees with himself, and if you think about it, you'd have to say the same thing too. Some of those things are desired by the people of the world. But what he overlooked, and what I, when I underlined it 10 years ago, overlooked, is that not necessarily all the people of the world, including the people coming up in our own society, were content with the way we were producing these technological changes and so on. And he said, therefore you have the problem in these societies that someone who looks as if he wants to change it radically can be very early and easily bought off. The Danegeld of the establishment, he says, is too big to have a revolution in such societies. Danegeld was the old money, here's a dictionary, I should look it up, which you sort of pay off your critics. Well, that happened to the early black leaders in the integration movement. How much fun we had to pointing out that that Lewis Lomax would write a critical book and get rich on it and buy a $150,000 home in Hollywood Hills and be one of us. And if only we could do that to all of them. Wouldn't it be nice? And so, if you want to change the society, you have to say, I'm not going to be bought off. That's why there's so much apparent bad manners in the student revolution. So much surliness ever since the blacks got uppity. If they begin to compromise, that ends the potential for change. What has happened, in other words, in recent years, is that we have great numbers of people, most blacks, students, young, not all of them, but the symbolic leaders, the ones we're nervous about, are not content with our approved social contract. And so they will listen. Now, all right, a new consciousness is developing, a new sensibility, a new mentality. Spell it out, Prof. And then I get very diffident. That's what I'm doing here this week. I'm saying it's not here yet. We're really living between some times here. Some people do write books about the subject. I read one this week by a man I think was here last year, John Cooper. Has a new book out called The New Mentality. Well, I could show you my copy. It has about 500 question marks on the margin. Because he's constantly spelling out what this new mentality is, and I keep thinking, uh-oh, he wrote this 6 months ago. And that's dated already. He has one chapter saying the new mentality is represented by people who follow the Maharishi. Well, you heard what I did to the Maharishi the other day. I just saw him heading back, and Cooper does have a little footnote that the Maharishi went back and felt that he had failed to convert Western society. He just stopped drawing audiences, that's all. Cooper is trying to pull off too soon an attempt to say what this mentality is. And he sees a great optimism that I'm not so sure I see among all these forces. So I don't think we're ready yet to say exactly what it is. What we, I believe, are involved in is a moment between the times when, in Harvey Cox's phrase, the stakes are being raised on both sides. In a book I wrote recently, The Search for a Usable Future, 495, Harper and Row, I have a chapter quoting Paul Ricoeur, a French philosopher who's influenced me very much. He says, the modern world is moving under a twofold sign of an increasing rationality and an increasing absurdity. In the middle of this, he says, man should be a prophet of meaning. He says, the Christian especially ought to be. I do not say that he can be this alone, but I say that he can be this for a special reason. The resurrection of Christ, the new creation, the commitment of the human capacity for building, preserving, and caring. But take just the first line. Under the twofold sign of an increasing rationality and an increasing absurdity. Now, my problem with most of the people who are talking about new consciousness, new sensibility, new worldview, new mentality, is that they're betting on one or the other. Pick up any books like this. Somebody said the only way you really have an impact on the thought of your time is by exaggerating. And so you write a book that will exaggerate one or the other. And a half a dozen years ago, all the books were exaggerating the increasing rationality of our time, right? Think back. In theology, I suppose the best example is something like Harvey Cox's Secular City. What was the vision there? Only thing you had to watch for was that the world was going to get more and more technological, rational, and the church should be God's advance guard to secularize it more than anybody else. Quite an interesting book even today, though its author is pretty nervous about it. Or the best example, I was reminiscing with Roland Bainton the other day about this one, William Hamilton's essay. William Hamilton was the most gifted of the Protestant Death of God theologians, very good autobiographer of our generation, wrote an essay called Thursday's Child, The New Optimism from Prufrock to Ringo. Any of you ever read it? It's in a book, Death of God and something else. I wish you would read it someday. I've often tried to figure out when it was written, and I think I know. I'll tell you in just a moment. But the essay is written in the spirit of this new Western rationality. The world is getting more and more logical and more technological, and man is more and more liberated from the gods, and there are fewer spooks around the corners, and nobody lives by omens and signs, and at last we're all free, and that's what Jesus had in mind all along. So God is dead, but Jesus, his son, is here. And how does the essay begin? It begins January 4th, 1965. We'll go down in history as the mark of a great turning point in human history. Two things happened that day, Hamilton said. T.S. Eliot died. And he was the last symbol of pessimistic, gloomy, tragic, liturgical, conservative Christianity. And with him goes all the potential in the Western world of ever dealing again with that tragic, gloomy dimension of life that existentialists like so much. And the same day something else happened. Our great president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, outlined the Great Society, which in Hamilton's description was very close to the Kingdom of God. And then he goes on to chronicle that year. Spring, Selma. The good guys. Will and I were both there. Right? How can you beat that? The good guys were marching. We were really... devils trembled. The kingdom was just about here. The president himself went on television the next night, "We shall overcome." He made our slogan his slogan. We'd already made somebody else's slogan our slogan. And then came March, mainly May, June, when the Great Society legislation came in. I used to open the paper every day, the kingdom is here. Boy, it's here at last. Congress is voting these things all over the place. Never did a thing about any, but they were voting them. And Hamilton says, all right, T.S. Eliot, the gods, the tragic, the gloomy, the absurd, the existential, all shot. What's the new symbol? Ringo Starr, the Beatles, the new optimism, and he had all the texts that came from that. Now, this was published in Theology Today in January of 66, and it came out in his book of June of 66, and nobody believed a line of it anymore. I think he wrote that about 5 minutes before Watts burned. He must have just shipped it off to the publishers. It takes about a half month to get something ready for a theological journal. And he must have just done it about then, because then Watts burned, and America suddenly knew there was a different phase in the race movement. From Selma to Watts is a half century. Vietnam was heating up that year. This is about the time that the man who wasn't Goldwater was committing land troops to Asia, something that every sensible Republican had told him nobody ever should do. The Great Society became a bad taste in people's mouths, so on. All right. So what happens? Everybody runs off the other way, and what's going on now? Everybody acts as if society's only growing in the other dimension, what Ricoeur called absurdity. I don't mean that everything I'm now going to talk about is absurd, but it's the other side of life. That which is not subject to the merely rational, logical, neat compartmentalization. New York Times about 6 weeks ago had an article by my colleague, Father Andrew Greeley, on the new religions on campuses, and he used the University of Chicago as the example, how he could draw far more people to a seminar on the occult than he could to a seminar on sociological statistics, as he might have a few years ago. How in his classroom, if he says a bad word about any kind of a Tibetan guru, he might get pelted, whereas a few years ago, he couldn't have even brought up the subject. Or as I said yesterday, to the people on the hillside, one of my students in reviewing a book, one of whose lines said that McCarthyism was the new Baalism of the 1950s, the student wrote back, "Unfair to Baal." Everybody's getting a new round. We're spooky, we're psychedelic, we're smoking pot, we're going to the East, we're trying Zen, and so on. Now, so Mr. Cooper writes his book with that view in mind. And what I'm saying, if Cox exaggerated one and Cooper exaggerated the other, if everybody has to exaggerate somehow, I'm going to exaggerate both, as I think Cox is doing now. His next book, after Secular City, will be called The Feast of Fools, or Festivity and Fantasy, and it's all about celebration, and he's out there kissing Sister Carita and doing things like we do in the next building and so on, whereas a couple of years ago it was all going to be only rational. What I'm getting at is this. Between these times, we are living with both of these signs present, and both of them stronger every day. The ABM debate was a part of this increasing rationality of the West, that you could program a set of weapons that will blast theirs out of the sky, and the only country that gets hurt is Canada. And the students are saying, we'll get some witches, and we'll go to each defense installation, we'll chant, and they'll fall down. They read the story of Jericho, and they're going to try that. Now, both of these things are happening. They're going to keep on happening more and more. I'm not going to talk about all phases of this new mentality. I only got 19 minutes to talk about any phases of it. But I am envisioning that for the immediate future, long enough that we better worry about how to build in the middle of it, we're going to continue to see an increase of these two signs. The best place that you can see the two of them on the same set of pages is in the book Toward the Year 2000, or just called The Year 2000, by Herman Kahn and Anthony Weiner. Kahn is the super genius who writes scenarios for escalation. He gave us most of the vocabulary for the war in Vietnam, escalation, pacification, and all those other things that don't mean what. In science, you have the same trouble you do in theology. If the word ends with ation, things are gummed up. You notice in the earlier session, Arndt Halvorsen wanted to get breakthrough words. And every time it came back with an Asian, he sort of had to say, well, it's probably right, but it isn't going to do anything. One student said to me, if what we're doing in Vietnam is pacification, then words don't mean anything. Look up pacification in a dictionary. If what we're doing in a city is reconciliation, look it up in the dictionary. Words don't mean anything. Asian words. All right, Kahn is that type. And he is figuring out a surprise-free, long-term, multifold trend for man, Western man. And then he wrote down the set of adjectives. He says the long-term trend, surprise-free, multiform, and so on, is toward an increasingly sensate culture, what Cox called the secular. I wish I could tip it up so you could see too, but it's all kinds of Asian words that we don't care. I did this in a speech recently where there were people from three languages present, and there were translators, and I had to take them all out for a drink after a while because they were all mad at me for spouting these adjectives. An increasingly sensate culture, by which I mean, says Kahn, increasingly empirical, pragmatic, contractual, hedonistic, epicurean, programmatic, utilitarian, and the like. All right. The German wasn't mad. He just said empirical, empirisch, pragmatisch, pragmatisch, and so on. He just ished them off. This is done again today so that I'm not disappointing anybody who wants one egghead minute at least. But remember, he put them here. These are samples. What is this? This is, in caricature form, Cox's and Hamilton's Secular Man. Empirical. You don't do anything unless you can test it out. Just matter-of-fact test. Pragmatic. Does it work? Mr. Kennedy, the cool style. Politics. Contractual. You arrange, you program, you schedule. Utilitarian. Fairly similar to this. Hedonistic. St. Hugh Hefner and his crowd. This is the man of the future, the culture of the future, the surprise-free, multiform, long-range trend. But, says Kahn, and that's what I meant with Ricoeur's phrase, rationality. But, says Kahn, not everybody would agree with me, and I do, in all honesty, have to report for the other side that most philosophers of history of the 19th and 20th century have seen a different long-term future. A philosopher of history is someone who deals with all of history. Historians like Bainton and I, as they have to wait till something happens. The philosopher of history writes books with titles like The Meaning of History. It's a perfectly legitimate discipline, I'm not knocking it, but it's a different thing. To write a book called The Meaning of History, you have to know its outcome. I don't know the meaning of something until I know the end of it. So a philosopher of history, someone who deals with the whole of history somehow. Teilhard de Chardin, Omega Point, the evolutionary process consummated in Christ. Paul Tillich, Arnold Toynbee, philosopher of history. He knows what is going to happen next in the civilization. Sorokin himself, Northrop, Hawking, Radhakrishnan, all of the people who write on the meaning of history. He said all of them agree on something else, that the long-term, multifold, surprise-free trend is that the future of man is going to be religious. Now, when he puts this here, he doesn't mean something real comfortable for Christians. Depends on how you define religious. He says it might be a new religion of science, like Julian Huxley's view. It might be the revival of historic religions. We've seen some of this in the 20th century. Christianity, Buddhism, Islam are all resurgent in some ways. It may be wholly new syntheses, like Toynbee, who thought you'd get a little bit of each of these religions into a world-integrating future. It could be Big Brother, which is a very religious world, ultimate concern. Religion can mean totalitarian rights and lefts, too. But as my colleague, many of you know him or have read him, Joe Sittler says, human history is too full of passions to be sustained merely secularly. I would say, this might work for operational man, this works for passional man. And I see people of our time, I don't know what man will be a million years from now, but I see people in our time as being both these. And the same people. A couple examples. And I apologize to who's from Orange County. I met somebody here the other day. Apologize to all Southern Californians in my little reference here. When people say the future of the world is Sweden, they're saying this. They say, here's a welfare state, technological program, contractual Epicurean, and with all those beautiful blonde people on the beach, hedonistic to boot. How can you beat that? And nobody goes to church. They still baptize, confirm, marry, bury, but they pretty well avoid it in between, and are doing more so all the time. That's the future. And then I say, well, how do we know? There's another part of the world, Japan and Southern California, which are, in my imagery, the most rapidly advancing technological, higher academic, computerized parts of the world, right? Where do you have bigger concentrations? Japan's the most literate nation. If you're like I, your camera, your bedside television, your portable Vivaldi thing that I have up here, you know, it's all Sony and Minolta and all that. But where do they do these things better? Southern California, aerospace, higher academics, and so on. And yet, Japan, since World War II, has 100 new religions, including Soka Gakkai, the fastest growing of the militant ones. A revival of Buddhism, some resurgence of a little bit of Christianity there, and so on. And, as you all know, if you're from anywhere but Southern California is our mythical center in America for every kind of old and new religion and cult and kook thing. A Saturday afternoon Los Angeles newspaper is to me the most interesting refutation of the fact that this is what man is. Every kind of swami gets a hearing there, divine metaphysical centers and all the rest.
Might point out that Saturday afternoon tells the church services the next day. You read the religious section, has Alma the Great with the greatest altar and all that.
Yeah.
You're accurate in your description.
Thanks. I was worried for a minute.
Hear it.
All right, now what's interesting to me is there aren't enough people to go around in Japan and Southern California to have two whole sets, right? There's got to be some overlapping. When Andrew Greeley writes about our students, he's not writing about a few ex-fundamentalists who are now reading Zen. He's talking about people in astrophysics who find that some parts of their lives are not being hit that way, and so they're doing the other. And I would have to say that most of the exciting people I know have a little bit of both of them in them. I always used to try to tell Harvey Cox that if the guy he was writing about ever showed up, He's all right, but would you want your daughter to marry him? a computer with legs. A sterile, sunny, God-at-me man in control. Who are the people who really interest us? The people who have a sense of awe, reverence, wonder, imagination, mystery. And you know, the best of these have it. And maybe the best of these have something of this. All right, I'm seeing there's this twofold sign. I ran into Bill Hamilton a year ago, April, at a conference. He has left seminary. He's teaching in a swinging college in Florida. I said, Bill, I haven't seen a book from you for 3 years. What's next? He said, it'll take another 3 years. I said, why? He said, well, it was easy to write about the world from a seminary, because what we called secular there was something very religious. We acted as if secular man wanted to talk about Jesus and the Exodus and remnant and all these words. He said, boy, when I talk to these college kids, when they're secular, they are so damn secular, it's atoms and molecules and that's it. I thought, well, that's right. I ran into them all day. I mean, you couldn't work the subject around to it. He said, on the other hand, what we called religion on the campus was very secular. Our chapel services were the most blah, bland, unemotional, drab, dry, dreary expositions of the eternal verities. And when these kids are religious, they're religious in astonishing, surprising, bewildering, and frightening, and funny ways. And again, he said, and it's the same kids doing both. And I don't know what it means. Well, when he does write on it, it'll be the best reporting on it that you'll get. He's very intuitive and gifted at listening to people like this. But we are in the middle of what Couture calls this twofold sign of an increasing rationality and an increasing absurdity. Herman Kahn's sensate man and his religious man. Kahn says, as you read these philosophers of history, they all say this stage follows this stage, and you can't move from this to this, for those of you who can't see, from the sensate to the religious, without a period of anarchy, chaos, upheaval. Now, you might say that's the moment we're in. I think as I look ahead, I have to say the human story. Constantly we're being given better instruments. Constantly we're less sure of our use of them. Constantly we're more free to be operational. Beautiful stuff goes on. Constantly we have more necessity to make sense of meaning in life. And if that happens, what these men see as a momentary stage of chaos and anarchy, I would say is something we're going to have to learn to live with. Maybe the new worldview is simply going to be the breakdown of the model of the old idea that you have a worldview that everybody kind of assents to, and we're going to find a great straining at both sides. Now that is an extremely risky, dangerous, volatile kind of world. As Hannah Arendt says, everything could turn into anything else almost at any moment. Wars, revolutions, rumors of wars, riots are a part of the language of it. And love, joy, peace, pop, gas, all the rest are part of the language of it. So we don't know what sense to make of it. Revolutionaries in the past, for example, were very puritanical. An article in the New York Times 2-3 weeks ago by a professor at St. Louis U says, this student revolution and this black revolution, they aren't going to work because they're not puritanical enough. Mao Zedong, their hero, is very puritanical. I always get a charge out of when Southern congressmen like Dickinson in Mississippi thinks that the movement is all that sexy. When you're fighting a war, you don't have time for all those things. As the guy in Arthur Kester's Darkness at Noon says, you eat, drink, sleep, get drunk to, make love to the revolution. But it's done in a kind of a puritanical sense. They're anti-sex, they're anti-expression. And yet, the people coming up on the scene are trying to bring together Freud and Marx. Some of you have been studying Marcuse here this week. I don't know the future. I don't know, can they pull off a revolution that is both ugly and fun? But the lingo that we're getting has some of the elements of both of these. And in this world, in which we're part of both of these, Hannah Arendt says, we have lost worldly permanence and reliability. We've lost the single authority to which we can appeal. And yet she says, this does not, I gave away all my copies, this does not entail, at least not necessarily, the loss of the human capacity for building, caring, preserving, and caring for a world which may be fit to survive and for following generations to come. I already blew that one, but you all have a pink or blue sheet somewhere to check it up. The human capacity. When the Christian uses that word, he doesn't, I don't think, mean Promethean man. I don't think he necessarily means man can do everything. To me, human capacity is itself based on grace. It accepts life as a gift. It is a response. It is a saying yes to a given. So when I use the word human capacity, don't go away today thinking that I'm saying man can do all these things. I'm saying man, given life, given ears, given grace, given response, given affirmation, should do it. Now, what I like about Hannah Arendt's quotation is she really has the three dimensions of what Christians are to be in the world right there, even though she isn't Christian and isn't writing a Christian passage. I like what she's doing because she's showing us that even if the conventional backdrop for doing good, get to heaven, avoiding evil, go to hell, even though that may be disappearing, we could love God for his own sake through loving his creatures. All right? Build. To me, the three things Christians do in the world, they build community, they preserve the earth, and they care for the person. And the people coming along are asking us, is the world as we now have it really building community? Do we have it? A couple days ago, I heard the wits talking about marriage. I see all these nuns and priests and bishops running off and getting married. They have a view that if they could only get out of that stifling community called the monastery into that warm, embracing community called the family, then they'd have it made. Bishop Shannon married a thrice-divorced woman. This one problem with Catholicism, you don't get out of it until about 45 or 50, and it's kind of picked over by then. You pretty well have to. So when Catholicism finally recognizes celibacy, it'll probably have to recognize divorce with it, and we Protestants will be the conservatives on divorce, because all of their people will have had to marry divorcees. John Cogley points out they usually come with three or four children, too, a built-in family, he says. Typical of them, isn't it? Lazy priests. All right, so what do? They're going to find this wonderful community called the family. Is the family, as we've got, a community in America? Somebody figured out that homes with teenagers, out of 21 meals a week, teenagers are at it with the whole family, maybe three or four meals. When does a family get together in the modern world? Golden Village, right. That's why we come. We're building community here, we hope. And I hope we can carry some of it back. All right. Preserve the earth. The trend is not yet toward preserving the earth. You listen to any park geologist and he will say, what came along in the course of 2 billion years can be ruined in 2 decades. The long pole future. I like to play games with time here. Remember our Grand Canyon story of the guy sitting at the edge and the ranger says it. Any of you know how long it took to carve this canyon? The guy says, 2 billion and 10 years. The ranger said, what? Wow, that's precise. How'd you ever come to that figure? Well, I was here 10 years ago and you said 2 billion. Or the other one on futures, which I put in my book, 495 Harper and Row, is that the lady who hears the scientist say that in, I think, what is it, 2 billion years or 200 billion, let's just say 2 billion years, the earth will heat up, it gets too close to the sun, and it'll just become one more little carbon crisp in the universe. And she came running up to him after a while and said, I wasn't sure what you said there. Did you say 2 billion or 2 million years? He said, I said 2 billion. She said, for a minute I thought you said 2 million. A lot of people have a feeling if it isn't going to be here forever, it doesn't pay to do anything about it. So we can pollute it and destroy it now. Care for the person. I must say that while the word didn't sound as dynamite-y as gas and dynamite, he twice said he wanted to root for caring. Care is the best word in Christian ethics. Care, regard for the other from within. And we've made much too little of this in our theology. My time is up. We've made much too little of it because we're always having to stress man's incapacity to get right with God on his own terms. And I'm in the first row of the cheering section there. But only in that realm does the Bible ever talk about the limit. All the rest of the time, he is to be co-builder of community. Why would Paul bother to tell us how we ought to live in the body of Christ if it were a finished product. He is to be co-preserver of the earth, have dominion, live with it, live in it. He is to be co-carer of the person to the neighbor. We don't do these, as I say, because we've lost sense of worldly permanence. We feel the system prohibits us from breaking through. And I think in the future, what we're going to have to do is learn to live with these extremes. And then, if we're Christian, and again with Ricoeur, I do not say that only the Christian can do it, but I say he can do it for a special reason. That's why the other night I wasn't able to buy a Christian lifestyle, but I was able to buy a Christian motivation. He does it for a special reason. The new creation in Christ, the resurrected life here and now, the sign of the future among us. And any of you who've been hungry one day knows how great a gift of life it is to be given one day. Any of you who've ministered to someone with a terminal cancer knows the joy to that person of moments surcease from pain and the brightness of another day's sun. You don't have to worry about 2 billion years and 2 million years. You have to worry about the situation before you. It's for this that I think we have to develop a new kind of person. I'll close with a little reference to what I think is lifestyle then. Charging right into coffee hour, which is a bad way to do it. It's going to be very quick. I have a couple of clues. The Christian lifestyle in such an age negatively cannot be MIM, M-I-M. That's my other technical word of the week. Great big messy church and MIM people. MIM, what is MIM? We have a children's book called Ounce, Dice, Trice by Alistair Reed, illustrated by Ben Shahn, which has new definitions and has a picture of a man sitting there like this and says, MIM people are people who always sit there like this with their hands together and their lips together and who always disapprove. MIM people ain't gonna make it. And the image that blacks, young, restless, third world, and everybody else has of the four ace Christians of the world is that they're MIM. All right? That's why we celebrate at Holden. Why liturgy? Carol said yesterday, it's the artists that turn the theologians on around here. I was raving to them about how the artists here, I saw one of the artists the other day, and it won't be nice when the people are gone and you can produce things, you won't be bothered by people anymore. He said, I like to be bothered by people. Okay. Interpersonality, as I tried to say on the lawn yesterday, making ourselves vulnerable to each other. You can't be MIM for that. All right, so three positive words. Gabriel Marcel, a French philosopher, has spoken of man's disponibilité, which best translates availability to others. Why does she want to sit on Baton's lap? Because you know that even if he's on a way to class and you got a problem, he'll let himself get late. I used to tell my congregation, being a very scheduled man, that the great gift is creative schedule interruption. The hardest thing you can get in a suburb. Have to have a woman dying of cancer and you want a different woman each day to spend a day with her. Try to spring her free from PTA and Little League mothers and all those other things. Creative interruptions get disponibilité, availability to other persons. Second, and I've spoken of this in the racial movement sometimes, spudagalaios, grave hyphen Mary. The Catholic theologian Hugo Rahner has said that the Christian style of life is characterized by people of spiritual elegance who know the tragic. They have taken the measure of the cramping existence of life and through Christ's resurrection still affirm. And so they laugh. Pope John is the grave Mary man of the 20th century. Serious view of the depth of human misery and full of little jokes. I think that this is something, again, of the style it's going to take to live with both of these. To laugh at the idols and the pretensions of both, and to see the concern that produces both, and to see in what way they enlarge the range of human possibilities. And finally, imagination. We let our imagination atrophy. I think that's what we really look for at a week like Holden. I thought last night, as that discussion went on, most of you must have been here, in some senses it seemed threatening. Maybe in some senses it was. Maybe some people have come so invulnerable they don't really let themselves open to each other, but not the vast majority. What really is going on? I thought, why isn't this going on at First Methodist Church Burbank? Why isn't this going on at St. John's Lutheran in Toledo? It does here and there, and that's the live churches. What happened? Churches are now the places where you park at the door any deep problem you have and let someone talk to you. Church ought to be the place where we debate selective conscientious objection and go home disagreeing, but having both subjected our moral vision to each other, to the word, and so on. For that, we do need the stimulus of interpersonality, of retreat, of art, of liturgy, to produce the kind of person who can live with both of these. Then you can build and preserve and care. What does Luther say? Even if they told me the world would end tomorrow, I would plant my apple tree today. You got that, you can do something instead of nothing. And that's better off than what we've got. Now, 30 seconds for topics for tonight's forum. Are there things you want to talk about tonight that grew out of these? Yes?
You suggest a couple yourself. What values are worth saving?
All right. And you all think about these too today, will you? If someone came up to you, not in general, not just the little flag in the window, love it or leave it, but what about it are we loving to leave? Okay, values. Some more?
Maybe we could have a preliminary run on your new course, The Current Revolution.
All right.
We'll help you.
We'll let it bob up here and there. I probably won't do it systematically, mainly because I don't know yet what the course is going to say. But we'll let it bob up some. The first one interests me more for a forum topic because it'll be a good way for us to see what is it that we're uptight about. What are we saving? A couple more? Anything else that came up in what I've been talking about?
How do we preserve human community when everybody's anxious?
Preserving community when we're off balance, okay? That's a third one. Any more? Out of what I've...
The fascination is greater than the frustration.
Pardon?
We discover the fascination is greater than the frustration.
Okay. I'll keep that under my category of imagination, which I didn't get to develop this morning. Yes?
How do we preserve the family in this time?
Family, good topic. The wits know more about it, but it might be fun to bring it into this kind of context, and they're gone, so I have to fake being Elmer tonight. Yep. Also, fake being Ginny, we'll have a... Cold coffee. Thanks for your attention.